Good afternoon, everyone, and I want to welcome you to this webinar, May 25, regarding our current population health survey results. Before we get started, I just wanted to go over just a few housekeeping issues as we all the participants are going to be muted. The audiovisual, if you're ready to talk, if any issues come up, please just give them a call. And then we have already downloaded our slides so that you can take a look and follow along as we go through the webinar. Just a few items about eHealth Initiative. It's an organization that's been here since 2001, always with the purpose of advocating the value of technology and innovation through health information technology. We convene a multi-stakeholder collaborative and focusing on our current focus is on our eHealth 2020 roadmap, and we're looking at areas of data analytics, data access and use with privacy and security, business and clinical motivators, and interoperability. We have a multi-stakeholder membership, as you can see from this slide. It covers from providers, payers, vendors, all working together to take a look at some of the critical issues around health information technology. This time, for this particular webinar, we really appreciate the generosity made through Medicity. We've got three fantastic speakers. We'll introduce them to you with more detail. We've got Dr. Charles Kennedy from Aetna. We've got Tricia Nguyen from Texas Health Resources and Dr. Sean Griffin from Memorial Hermann. On that note, I'd like to make a special welcome to Dr. Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is the Chief Medical Officer for of Clinical Integration with Aetna, and he's responsible for the population and care management strategies, working with health systems and provider organizations to design and implement population health management programs. And on that note, I'd like to welcome Dr. Kennedy to provide a few opening remarks.
Well, thank you, and good morning and good afternoon, everyone. It is certainly an exciting time in the healthcare industry for those of us who are interested in the topics of quality of healthcare, affordability of healthcare, and improving the overall service experience. I can't think of another time where there have been as many fundamental new concepts being propagated throughout the industry, specifically the concept of value. When I was in medical school and in my training, I don't know if the word value ever came up once in my training, and yet today it really is all the rage in how we are trying to adapt our healthcare system to be more affordable to the American population and also simultaneously not just offer cheap care, but high quality as well, thus value. Also, the term population health is now literally everywhere. Again, a concept during my training, and I may not be that old, which, again, never came up, and it's a new theme for us as an industry to get a better handle on. We have new policies from the federal government that are intelligently crafted, I would argue, but are also very ambitious, both in terms of their breadth and their depth. We also have private sector alignment, and you see the private sector making aggressive moves toward value and population health and doing many, many fundamental things. For instance, you may have noticed my title change. I'm really focused on the Aetna-Humana integration, and one of the biggest reasons Aetna pursued Humana is their strong presence in Medicare Advantage. One could argue the very foundation or the original value-based healthcare product set. We have delivery systems that are pursuing all kinds of innovations around vertical integration, horizontally expanding through mergers and acquisitions, and diversifying their skill sets into new areas. But with all of these changes also comes some concerns. Are we trying to do too much too quickly? Are the IT systems, are any of the IT systems ready to support a value-based healthcare industry? And do we have appropriate alignment between the payment strategies and the notion of value-based healthcare, which is really done on an individual basis, whereas the notion of population health could be construed as an average payment for an average patient. And so with that in mind, we're going to walk you through a survey that was done by EHI to begin to get a little bit of insight into where the industry is and what various leading organizations are doing in preparing for this new world. So I'm going to turn it back over to Claudia, who will walk us through survey results. Claudia?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Kennedy. So on our agenda, as you can see, I'm going to be just giving you a brief overview of the survey results and then turn it back to Dr. Kennedy to have a facilitated discussion with our panelists, Dr. Nguyen and Dr. Griffin. So we conducted the survey. We collected the results April through May. These are the areas of focus. And how we did this is we had a really broad, we had a great opportunity to reach out to several different organizations to see if we can get, you know, more than just a couple of different of the stakeholders. And so we were actually able to get, and you'll see, a nice array of different respondents. We had our network of ACOs. We partnered with Premier, who also sent out the survey to their ACOs, and we want to thank Premier for helping us out with that. And then we followed up a couple of times. And, you know, as with any survey, it's sometimes it's a challenge, but I think we were able to get a pretty good array of respondents and information to give an idea of where we are with population health. So on this slide, it shows who the respondents are. And, you know, this really shows that it does cover a really nice broad scope of respondents to this survey. And of course, you know, there were some that responded, you know, we had more from some organizations than others, but we still have enough input to provide a nice broad spectrum of responses. Now, the support for population health management, this really was looking at, you know, what organizations are doing in their initiatives to show that they understand the value of population health management. And based on these statistics, it shows that there is terrific support. And we noticed, we did the survey last year, and we noticed that there was a definite increase in percentages of those who responded this year compared to last in terms of the support for population health management initiatives. You know, this is always an interesting. I know that Dr. Kennedy is going to be talking more about payment models, but the support is really strong for alternative payment models, and that really does underline the support for population health management initiatives. When it comes to understanding, you know, where the information is, health being stored, used, accessed, I think these statistics really show that there's a broad array of sources and support for information technology, and you know, definitely well received by providers and growing. This information shows that population health management is really doing what it's supposed to do. It shows that there's really a focus on these high-risk populations. And and then what's terrific is that there's also a measurable positive outcome with results. So again, you know, it's always about the data. And the data sources are growing. There is still the data is also collected not only for clinical care, but it's also collected for things like patient satisfaction. And the types of data cover from lab, pharmacy, health risk assessments. And to me, when I look at the statistics on there, I see that things like lab data and clinical data from electronic health records are still the largest sources of where the data is collected. And, you know, to go back and look at this statistic for patient-generated data, it's still a little bit on the low end, and that's understandable, considering that a lot of this patient-generated data is still relatively new, and people are understanding more about how to utilize this. We know where the data is stored, where it's accessed, who uses it, and this slide really shows how it's used. And organizations are really using the data to improve care, reduce costs, and ultimately improve performance as well. So how do they find the patients? And right now we found that the largest percentages of sources for these patients are still in case findings and actually referrals. Now patient engagement, I mean, this is something that's near and dear to my heart in terms of patients really becoming more engaged in their own healthcare and for better outcomes. And I think this slide really shows some fantastic growth in the area of patient engagement as it's associated with health information technology tools. So the tools are ever increasing. It's hard to keep up with from patient portals, and now with things like wearables, it's an ever growing and changing field. The care management steps, although to me, when I look at these statistics, I see that although 82% are developing a care plan, I think that we could still use some growth in terms of some of the newer forms of data collection when we look at a statistic like the remote monitoring. So what's interesting to me also is how the information is actually shared with the care team. And right now, it does seem that they're still using the traditional methods of sharing the data with meetings, actual in-person meetings. And although there's nothing wrong with that, it just shows that people are still utilizing a lot of traditional formats for sharing of information. So the key barriers, I think to summarize this slide, I think the key barriers are IT adoption and cost, and how it impacts workflow, learning how to use the technology, and of course funding of the technology. So this is my last slide. When we look at some of the data from last year and look at some of the data from this year, we've seen a few trends, and in terms of the groups that are beginning to connect to newer technology, it's encouraging to see that newer technologies and innovations are happening, such as remote monitoring and telemedicine, for example, and of course we hope to see this number grow. In terms of the payment models that are driving the focus, groups continue to focus population health efforts on the super utilizers, those with the chronic conditions and the readmission risks. And this goes hand in hand with what we see with the Medicaid and Medicare ACOs and patient-centered medical home models that are the most common alternative payment models. And so these bundled payments, commercial ACOs, and capitation are showing up in a smaller contingency, which we will expect also to grow. And then the last trend that I'd like to highlight is the analytics. Analytics need to lead to actionable information. And most of the population health data that's being shared in traditional ways with providers, about half is shared in provider meetings and through scorecards. And so, it just shows that it's happening, but it's still based on some of the traditional models. And so we need to focus on what's happening with the data after it's collected. Is this information that providers are acting on? How is it being used? How is it being analyzed? Is it in a format that people can actually utilize and take action right away? So that's what we noticed with the trends from this year and last year and going forward. And on that note, I'd like to turn this back to Dr. Kennedy.
Great. Thank you, Claudia, for running through that quickly and efficiently. What I'm going to do now is try to produce a short framework for the discussion that we'll have with our two expert speakers. So next slide, please. So I mentioned in my opening comments about the themes of value and population health. And there's another word that needs to be thrown into that mix, which is the notion of accountability. In our traditional fee-for-service, broad network access products, be they Medicare or private payer provided, it's very difficult to introduce the concept of value when literally any patient can go anywhere at any time for any service. And so you've seen CMS, this is actually a CMS construct on this slide, say in a pretty bold and transformational way that they are forecasting the end of fee-for-service medicine and that it will be replaced with really two arms. The first arm being fee-for-service, but with increasing and stronger incentives for efficiency and quality, known as the MIPS program, as well as an arm directly branched into risk-based managed care. Managed care from a payment schema perspective, but also with quality measures baked in as well, both in support of better value for the American consumer. The way this is being manifested is through the notion of population health, where the delivery system and physicians participating in Medicare will be held financially accountable, or rather their financial income will be influenced by not just the volume of procedures that they have on a particular patient, but increasingly by the effectiveness of those procedures, those interventions, those admissions in maximizing population health. And so I think when you think of that one simple statement, the ramifications for providers, for payers, for hospital, even for pharmaceutical firms, are fundamental and wide-ranging. Next slide. Now, you probably noticed, as Claudia was going through the survey results, that the population we surveyed was a little bit skewed. The goals for CMS in terms of expanding the impact of value-based care and population health, the goals are only to have 30% of Medicare fee-for-service be an advanced payment model by the end of 2016, and 50% by the end of 2018, and have 85% of Medicare fee-for-service be in a MIPS or value-based type of approach. And you probably saw in our survey that over 60% of the respondents indicated that they were already in some kind of a Medicare or private payer ACO. So the results you saw definitely, I would say, are skewed a bit toward the organizations that are already thinking about how to move in the direction of value-based care and have already started down the path of preparing for population health. Next slide. In many ways, the MIPS program might be considered the stepchild to the Advanced Alternative Payment Models program, because when you look at the difference between implementing technology and actually using that technology to create better care for patients and to make it more affordable, there's quite a few leaps between the deployment of the technology and the realization of the result. And we're all struggling as an industry with making that linkage tighter, more compelling, and more measurable. In support of this, CMS and private payers are very much aligning with this. For instance, at Aetna, we have a program similar to what's in the oncology care model you see here. So this is really an industry-wide trend. It's to develop programs that help physicians financially in the attainment of higher value healthcare, but focus these programs on specific areas of impact, be they high cost, high intensity areas such as oncology, or lower cost but more broadly applied areas such as primary care, as witnessed by the new Primary Care Plus program that was just announced. Next slide. And so the reason this slide and one slide, I think, really sums up why we think these changes are really going to stick and are really going to drive industry change. If you look at the traditional fee schedule, you see that and this is Medicare, the physicians will expect a 0.5% increase in the Medicare fee schedule each year through 2019. But at 2019, the MIPS program kicks in, and you begin to see plus or minus 4% swings based on your composite MIPS score, with that score being composed of your use of technology, quality measures, value modifier measures, and a clinical practice improvement activity. Well, 4% moving to 9% of Medicare reimbursement being at risk, either upside or downside, is, I think, a potent enough force that no delivery system will be able to ignore it. And I think they're going to have to embrace the changes necessary to be successful in that program, or jump to the alternative, advanced alternative payment model, which right off the bat gives you a 5% fee schedule bonus, but also offers even greater opportunities for financial advancement, again, assuming that care is developed, get care is delivered in a quote-unquote high-value way. And so to kind of get a real-world, next slide, so to kind of get a real-world orientation to what delivery systems are doing to prepare for this change, and implement these changes, we have two folks who are absolute experts and have very, very deep experiences in leading delivery system change. Our first speaker is Dr. Tricia Nguyen. Tricia is the Executive Vice President for Population Health at Texas Health Resources, but she's also the President of the Texas Health Population Health and Education and Innovation Center, a center that she's really been the driving force in building. This center shares best practices for disseminating information about innovative approaches to managing disease more effectively. This center also helps drive physician-directed population health initiatives and looks at coordinating care on a community basis with a specific focus on well-being. I've actually known Tricia from her previous job, where she was the Chief Medical Officer for Banner Health Network for the Accountable Care organization, and she actually contracted directly with Aetna, directly with me at the time, and I can tell you firsthand her commitment and focus on offering better value health care to the individuals who get their care in that area. Our second speaker is Dr. Sean Griffin. Sean is the Chief Quality and Informatics Officer for Memorial Hermann. He serves as the CMS liaison and quality contact for the Memorial Hermann ACO. And in this position, he directs quality measurement, data collection, and has really been a driving force of one of the most successful MSSP programs in the nation, with almost 2,000 physicians enrolled over approximately 800 practices. He's nationally recognized as a speaker, a featured presenter for the National Quality Forum, AMGA, AMA, et cetera. So we have two folks who are really leaders in driving transformation at the delivery system level. And so with that, I'm going to pause and maybe ask Tricia to start and give a brief overview of your organization and your path that you're pursuing toward value-based healthcare and population health. Tricia?
Yes, thanks, Charles. based on what Charles has shared in the survey, I mean, I think there are three so far takeaways for me. One is there's no turning back from the direction of value-based payments, because I hear people in other systems saying that they're going to wait and see because they're thinking that this will be similar to the HMO days way back when. So there's no turning back, as you could saw what Charles has shared on that particular slide. And two is there's no real single platform that covers all the technology needs to truly manage populations, and they're best of breed across multiple different vendors that you may have to put together to make a complete stack to manage populations holistically. And three is how do we all move to being more accountable for the health delivery systems? And so Texas Health, over the last few years, have been managing populations with some form of shared risk and also full risk arrangement. And so has UT Southwestern. And the two of us are coming together to become a clinically integrated network under the new name of Southwestern Health Resources. And just with the two entities coming together, you can see we have a significant footprint in North Texas, which is 27 hospitals, more than 300 outpatient facilities and clinics, and it amounts to over 3,000 physicians across the 16-county area that we cover. And so with that breadth of a footprint, we are starting to create narrow networks or high-value networks to go direct to either employers or payers to be more accountable for the populations that are being seen by our providers and our entities. And the investments we've made so far between technology and the people resources have been focused on the top 5%, and the measures that Claudia shared earlier predominantly is readmits, ER, and admits that are the driving cost, driving levers of total cost of care. And then for the rising risk, which could be up to 15% of the population, we're closing care gaps for now. But what we really need to do, if we're going to assume full risk for more populations, we're going to have to invest in more interventions and technology to identify the rising risk and intervene timely, but also the other 80% of the population that hasn't seen anyone and is at risk for developing a chronic condition or have a chronic condition that's not undiagnosed because they have not engaged with the healthcare ecosystem. And so the technologies that we've invested in is the data aggregation, integration. We have some tools that create insight so that we can generate actionable information to then deploy into the workflow, leveraging our care managers and working directly with the physician to mitigate clinical risk. And so that's where we are today as an integrated network. I'll turn it back to you, Charles.
Okay. Thank you, Tricia. John, if I could ask you to do the same thing for Memorial Hermann.
All right. If you go ahead to the next slide, I just put together a couple of background slides for the people on the call. One of the largest not-for-profit health system in Southeast Texas. I'll tell you that this is not intended to be a Texas webinar, although it seems to be a good representation. We're 13 hospitals, over 2,800 licensed beds. I won't read you these things. We're a big organization. We're the dominant organization in the Houston market. One of the things that distinguishes us is that we've been the most financially successful Medicare Shared Savings Program for the first 2 years of existence with over $110 million in savings. One of our unique factors is that we have about 2,000 physicians who make up our ACO, but only about 10% of them are employed. So this really is the cobbling together of a network of physician practices. I always say about 800 practices, 300 different EMR databases. And so I think that our experience with bringing together different physicians, different practice styles, employed, academic, independents, and trying to bring together those, I think we've seen every technology that has ever been sold in the marketplace, including some that never should have been sold, that we've tried to integrate. And I would just like to echo Tricia's comments that there is no fundamental technology answer that provides you all of the tools that you need for managing populations. And my original practice was actually in rural Missouri and in a small city in Missouri. And I always thought back then if I just was in a big city and I had different resources, these answers would be easier. There are no easy answers to some of these questions that we're dealing with. And whether MACRA changes before the final regulations come out, all of you need to be aware of MACRA, need to be digging into MACRA. You know, you don't need to read the 962 pages yourself, but you do need to be watching as to how things are moving with that design, no matter what happens with the election. Next slide. I just wanted to share with you folks sort of our experience with the MSSP, the evolutions that we've had of Memorial Hermann. I think that for a lot of hospital organizations, there is an evolution in progress of going from hospital-centered thinking and contracting to population management. And I will tell you that if the people who are hospital-centered in their thinking are doing your contract negotiations, they're going to miss things because it is a very different type of contract where you're not just looking at rates and those things. We have been exploring narrow network contracts and co-development products. And we have been very successful with growing our lives. We started out with about 30,000 lives just with our own employees a few years ago, and now we've moved over 300,000, moving to 500,000 contracted lives in various levels of risk and with various levels of exposure. I think also your hospital has to understand that in the future population management world, a hospitalization is actually a failure. And it is that's not when you give somebody a high five when you've got more admissions to the hospital. That's actually a negative. And how that affects both the finances and the operations of an organization will be significant. You also, in our market, we had where our primary care physicians were pushed out of the hospitals, where we had hospitalists and we had specialists. And so we have had to reestablish relationships with our community physicians because your primary care physicians will be your wallet for driving your organization when it comes to population health. And when you start going from where you're trying to get physician engagement to where you're getting physician alignment and they're actually working with the same goals is a fundamental change that most organizations will have to go through if they have not. And employment does not solve all of your issues because I have seen some physicians who collect the paycheck from the mothership but then don't care for the mothership. And so you need to be working with all of your physicians, how to align them and how to work with them. And I believe that right currently, just to pontificate a little bit, there's probably an overemphasis on the hot phrase of big data right now. And I think that Tricia's comments about meaningful data at the moment of decision-making in the flow of care is really the challenge that we face. And if your organization is thinking that bringing in social media tweets from all of your patients is going to be the key to their health, you're probably going to be chasing a rabbit that's very tough to pin down. I've joked before that the most meaningful information I could get on most of my patients was their Walmart receipts for the past 6 months to find out how their health is going, or possibly a short quiz that asked them how many of the Kardashian children they know their first names, that may be more predictive to their overall health and activity status than any risk assessment I do. Next slide. One more. I wanted to share with you folks some of our commercial ACO results, and this is an example of managing a population and just some data points here. Our medical spend that we had for this population, we were able to work with our physicians to make it to hit a target, to hit an actual performance 15% lower spend than the target in a narrow network, but yet we also saw a 20% increase in enrollment. So it's not that the members who enrolled in this plan hated it. They actually liked it, and they liked the savings. And some of the efficiency results there at the bottom, when you can drive down your high-tech radiology visits, your impactable medical admissions, your ER visits, and your CT scans, when you can drive those down, you can see where the cost savings comes from. And that is an ability to deliver in a defined network benefit and a network design that benefits the patients. And I would say that To do those things and deliver high quality and high satisfaction is where we're all going to have to go. And this was an early example of some of the things that CMS is working to write into regulations. Go ahead, next slide. I think the next two slides are just my best in the country MSSP performance. So next slide. This is the years one and two, and they look very similar if you look at the two slide decks. But we were far and away the most successful Medicare Shared Savings Program in the country with our physicians. And when you look across, it's a little bit disappointing to say that, two-thirds of the MSSP programs did not make any savings money from CMS in participating in the program. And our organization saved $110 million and has about $60 million in savings that we have generated. And so I could go out and I could buy any system out there if it was the system that was going to be the answer to this, but it's not a system, it's not a technology. Our biggest investment has been building our ambulatory care management network and having the right people who work to engage patients and close gaps and work with physicians to improve their coding and their documentation and their workflow and their efficiency, and that's really where we have seen the most bang for our buck in delivering the results that we have been able to deliver. I would encourage everyone on the call to, there's two phrases for it. You can either adopt best practice or you can steal shamelessly from other organizations. They're the same thing. But make sure that you're networking with other organizations so that you can find out how they're approaching the challenges that we all face and maybe save yourself some stubbed toes and some painful nights. I think that's the last slide that I had, so I would just turn it back over to the other distinguished panelists for further discussion.
Great. Sean, thank you so much for that. That was both illuminating and a little bit exciting, quite frankly, to see an organization have such significant success. What I'd like to do is maybe throw out a few kind of comments, and then I'll keep an eye on the chat window to see if folks from the audience have questions. But one of the areas I'd like to explore a little bit more, Sean, you touched on it quite a bit, as did you, Tricia, is that when we look at the new regulations coming as a result of MAPRA, there seems to be a change in those regulations. Originally when we were building Meaningful Use through the HIT Policy Committee, our goal was really to ensure that the taxpayers' money was spent wisely. And so there were a variety of requirements that were put in, kind of as thresholds. You had to clear this bar in order to get the additional taxpayer funds. What we're starting to see in the new regulation is less of a threshold perspective and more of a perspective on, now that the technology is out there, demonstrate that you can use it to actually improve patient outcomes, that you can actually use it to continuously improve performance. And when I look at that, there seems, my perspective is, there's a pretty big gap between deploying technology and getting a result. And we might call that change management overall. How have you guys thought about change management in your journey? And if there were certain things, you talked about networking, shamelessly leveraging best practices, but what about more within your organization? As you tried to drive the change, what are the things that you would really point to around change management?
I can start. One of the things that we need to do when we try to move a large health system or IDN from fee-for-service to fee-for-value, it does require changing the metrics that we measure success and performance upon. And so it's taken some time, but we now have fee-for-value metrics like quality measures, ambulatory quality measures, lives under management, things like that align our incentives as a system towards value. And so it's got to start with the incentive alignment, but two is to involve the individuals at the front line with defining, designing the pathways, the protocols, and the care model going forward. I think those are two big things that we've focused on over the last few years here at THR.
And I would just echo those things. I think that those are incredibly important organizationally. At a simpler level, you know, we have been doing clinical integration down here at Memorial Hermann for almost 10 years now. So we had a fairly good head start on the culture necessary to where you have evidence-based medicine, where you have collaboration, those things. Just from a very practical standpoint, when we looked at our primary care physicians years ago, we shared with them where we thought medicine was going, and most of these are small one- and two-doctor practices. They said that they were terribly ill-equipped to try and adjust to that environment. So we stood up a practice transformation team that went into our individual offices and worked on patient-centered medical home updates to our practices to help them become NCQA Level 3 certified. And that was very useful in some respects for sort of bringing everyone's capabilities up to a similar level across our primary care network. I can tell you that the problem with patient-centered medical home, I would say, is the same problem as there is with meaningful use. You can become so focused on checking the boxes for criteria that you don't actually change what you're doing significantly. So I felt that the updated regulations regarding meaningful use in the macro legislation was a very enlightened view of recognizing that if you threw a bunch more check boxes, what you were finding is that the EMR systems were getting overbuilt to hit those requirements, and there was a loss of efficiency and a loss of usefulness for those tools. And so I'm hopeful that the simplification that we have seen with MACRA and with NIPS is going to allow greater flexibility for physicians to focus on workflow and outcomes and not on did they check the seven boxes that they needed to on the screen.
Great. Couldn't agree more. Another area that you both touched on is the underlying challenges with the technology and the associated products that are available to us. And I have to say that echoed pretty strongly with my experience. I chaired the HIT Policy Committee's subcommittee on ACOs and technology, and we had a fairly long and fairly strident group of physicians representing delivery systems from across the country, really detailing their challenges with using the existing technology set. In some ways, that's not a surprise, given that most of these technologies were built and developed before the notion of value was really meaningful in the industry. So as you look to the future, are there certain enhancements? You know, we talk a lot about interoperability. Are there certain things you think are key capabilities that are absolutely critical for getting better value from the technology? Or as you went through your evolution, kind of looking in retrospect, what are the technology capabilities that you would really focus on if you were to do it over again?
I think you started with the interoperability. I mean, all these EHRs are so siloed, it is a challenge to try and work across them. And evidence-based medicine is not being practiced on a routine basis because there's so much knowledge that's generated and it's hard to keep up with. And so if we're truly going to manage populations, we need to be able to deliver evidence-based pathways, guidelines, protocols at the point of care, and the only place that's going to have an impact is in the EHR because the doctors are only working in the EHR. All these care management platforms are wraparounds and additional, and so care managers and the rest of the care team may work in a care management platform, but it doesn't really integrate well. It doesn't insert or bidirectional information flow from the EHR to the care management platform and vice versa. And so data is being collected and recollected from each individual that touches the members or patients. And that's just within a CIN, not to talk about all the other people that are touching the individual from the payers to the post-acute. I think there was a recent number on the number of touches should someone get admitted to the hospital and discharged home after a skilled nursing facility stay is 15 within a month's period of time by multiple people trying to mitigate the risk of readmission. And so because the systems don't talk to each other and it's not easy to integrate and share data across, it's a tremendous challenge. If that's one thing that we could solve for to make it transferable and across care settings and providers, that is a huge win.
Now, I would say that one of the things that we're all burdened by is the fact that our current EMRs are basically monuments to meaningful use requirements. And trying to, you know, if next week all of a sudden our physicians were paid for taking care of populations and it wasn't about E&M coding and it wasn't about ICD-10 and they could just take care of patients, I don't think many of them would be using EMRs. And for years we talked about physicians weren't adopting technology very well. Well, it's actually that physicians don't adopt bad technology very well. And they were looking for things that were actually multipliers of benefit, not multipliers of work. And as our physicians got into these tools, they overwhelmingly said, this is far too complicated and it's not worth my time. Gee, I wish I could retire. And I think that the workflow and the reducing of the burden on the people using the tools has to be one of the benefits that we go after as organizations. And the fact that we have to, that we'd have 15 people contact you, one of the things that we did just at a very detailed level is when we negotiated a contract for a narrow network product, we sat our care management teams down with the hospital care management teams, with the payer care management teams, and we said, okay, we all need to get information after a hospital visit. Can we have one group make this call but collect the information that's needed for everyone so that the patient doesn't have five calls on day two of discharge? And I think that collaboration and cooperation and segmentation of the work so that we're not having so much rework would just be a tremendous benefit going forward.
Great, great, well said. You know, you picked up on a theme I'd like to maybe ask you to expand on a little bit, which is the importance of collecting data from the patient. You know, when I sit with my health plan hat on and you know, contemplate that as we struggle with affordability, you know, 80 cents on the dollar, roughly depending on the population, is associated with chronic disease management, and chronic disease is largely managed in the home, obviously with guidance and care direction from the physician. The importance of behavior, habit, diet, exercise, all of those things are critical to helping us bend the medical trend, so to speak. Simultaneously, you have a fair number of physicians who say, gee, I'm being increasingly held accountable for things that are outside of my control, that are really based on patient commitment and patient willingness to embrace what they need to do to manage their disease. And as we move in the direction of value-based care, I'm worried that problem is only going to get worse. How do you all think about engaging the patient from both a data collection perspective as well as a behavior modification or influence perspective?
I'll take this one first then. I think that anyone who is taking a look at population health and digs into the numbers sees that the behavioral components are a tremendous source of spend that could be better directed. Now, whether that's because of behavioral issues or substance abuse issues or things like that, influencing medical conditions and the interplay of those things, I think that all those things come into effect. But you also start seeing about how many of your inappropriate ER visits are the result of behavioral issues being redirected or not being addressed and ending up in the ER. I think we're all going to have to do a better job of behavioral health, whether it be integrated into the primary care offices, whether it be done remotely, those things. I think that's probably a massive untouched network of opportunity that we all need to work on. I will also say that as you do that, finding the appropriate caregivers for doing that work is challenging depending upon your market, and constructing incentive programs that align that sort of behavior that you want and disincentivize the behaviors you don't want is something that employers are asking us about. You know, our employers, when they come and they talk to us about our ACO and our products, they ask, what's your behavioral health network? How are you going to integrate that into the care that you give? I'm all impressed that you can cut down on your CT scans, but how are you going to help me with the depression leading to my absenteeism of my employees? And I'd say that the tools are not really there yet on that. Most organizations are very good at generating a claims-based risk score, but we found that to be ineffective to truly gauge the risk of a patient. And so we go and we do behavioral-based interviewing to come up with a care management risk score, which is claims-based, but also, you know, societal support-based and economic-based, and all those factors come into play. And I think that that's a maturing that we're going to have to go through as we build these systems out and as we build our networks out.
I agree with everything that Sean said. I think that it's being an accountable care organization, it's not enough to just take on risk for 80% of the medical expense ratio. In order to engage the population, you have to have a seat at the table to help drive benefit design that will incentivize individuals to be more accountable for their own behavioral health decisions and choices that they make on a daily basis. Because when we talk about ACOs, we're talking about how to hold the health system, the care delivery system, accountable for the outcome of the population. But yet, the other 50% of the cost equation is individual choices and behaviors. And now is a time for providers to step up to be at the table to help drive benefit design to allow us to engage and encourage engagement with the system to manage their health care better. And so that's why I think this is all very exciting, but there's not a real mechanism, especially if you're in a Medicare Shared Savings ACO or even next-gen ACO. There's not a real mechanism to engage the population because they still have choice and they're just going anywhere to get care today. But in these narrow network design products, you have that opportunity to be at the table with the payers and the employers to define benefit design changes to incentivize individuals to participate. And so the second thing I'd say is that most behavioral health services and care being delivered is either by behavioral health specialists like a psychiatrist, psychologist, but predominantly is delivered by primary care. And I'm an internist and pediatrician by training. I spent maybe at best a month in medical school rotating through the behavioral health studies. And then in residency, I might have gotten 2 or 3 days in total in talking about and learning about behavioral health. And so we're just not equipped. And if we're going to have more accountability for populations and we know how important behavioral health is, then we need to create some mechanism to either retrain or increase the number of behavioral health specialists out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, really well said. You know, the thing that comes to mind as I hear you speaking, both of you speaking, is the old adage, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And when I've gone out and looked at the various patient-facing tools, I've generally found, you know, kind of EMRs who might be limited by the silo of what they know about the patient, rudimentary data models, which don't offer the ability to kind of customize algorithms or analytics to reflect the unique nature of each patient, or, you know, like ourselves, we have claim data with some amount of clinical data integrated on top of it, but certainly there are limitations with, you know, how far you can go with claim data, even if you do some some amount of patient surveying. So maybe in our last few minutes, do you all, how confident, oh, and then when I look at the survey, that was one of the lowest areas of organizations being able to capture data was directly from the patient. So as you kind of look to the future, are there any words of wisdom or any specific technologies or approaches that give you confidence we're going to be able to do a better job in embracing the behavioral health needs of a population?
I think that there are a lot of startups and companies out there trying to get into the space of coaching populations. So I do have hope in the future on this. But for now, I think that if you're thinking about taking on risk for populations of individuals, focusing on the top 5% is a place to start. But you should also be looking at some low-hanging fruit to manage beyond the 5%, and that's closing care gaps for diabetics, for example, or CHF patients that aren't on the correct meds, patients on high-risk medications. All those things you could do, and I don't think that you necessarily need sophisticated predictive models to do that. If you have a way to manage claims and clinical data so that you can identify people that meet a set of criteria for which you're going to have an intervention for, that would be a way to go. And over time, and I'm very hopeful over time, that there will be more sophisticated technology and tools to help you better identify and stratify the population for an intervention.
Yeah, I would say that I see behavioral health as being sort of the next wave. I think that we've seen a lot of analytics companies the past few years sort of pop up with ideas, and I think that behavioral health, as we get into these arrangements, is going to be one of the next big waves that comes out. I also think that doing some of the things that were just mentioned and helping physicians take better care of populations, I think also feeds the idea of why people went into medicine. And if you're finding tools and information delivered to your providers in a timely and usable manner that helps them to understand that what they're doing actually has meaning beyond simply contract metrics or a shared savings amount, that you're actually feeding the desire that brought them to the profession in the first place. And so we talk a lot about vision and how it's not just about the dollars, it's about taking better care of people. And we love to point out that because of our numbers and improvements in quality gap closure, you know, there's diabetics who today are able to see their children who would not have been able to if we had not gotten their diabetes under control. And there's people who, when they got out of bed this morning, had 10 toes and they wouldn't have if we hadn't gotten their diabetes under control. And I think that that's important to communicate to your providers. And I think that a sharpening of the information that we're giving you providers and engagements, focused engagements around behavioral health and equipping patients to better take care of themselves, because they're actually the lowest cost provider in the entire chain of care. And if we can educate them and engage them better and give them the tools that they need, then that benefits everyone. And you probably have a better patient 2 years from now than if you simply sent them a postcard about their colonoscopy.
Great. Well, look, we're out of time, but I think the takeaway message here is, look, the public policy incentives seem to be improving and seem to be aligned toward value and population health. I think you've heard a lot of alignment between our expert speakers around the things that need to be done to be successful in population health. And so I hope everyone on this call found their information valuable. Yes, we still have technology challenges, but it sure looks like there's an emerging path here toward success, toward the triple aim. So with that, thank you so much to both of our panelists for your perspectives and your insights, and thank everyone on the call for taking an hour of your time to listen in.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Kennedy, for being such a fabulous facilitator, and thank the participants and, of course, our speakers. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach us at eHealth Initiative, and we look forward to seeing you on future webinars. Thanks again.